Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Bruce Erickson, Managing Partner of the San Francisco office of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. I'd like to welcome our radio audience and remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Pitch and Kathy Johnson. Today we are pleased to have as our speakers two distinguished American statesmen, former U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz and former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry. Together, in collaboration with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and former Senator Sam Nunn, they are directing the Nuclear Security Project, a project aimed at ending nuclear weapons as a threat to the world. They believe that the world now faces a new and dangerous nuclear era. They say that the likelihood of non-state terrorists obtaining nuclear weapons is increasing, as are the number of nations pursuing nuclear weapons. Today they will tell us how they believe their goal of a nuclear-free world can be achieved. Before I introduce them, let me list just a few of their many accomplishments. George Shultz was the 60th U.S. Secretary of State, having served under President Reagan. He also served as both Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of Labor under President Nixon and was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Eisenhower. Currently, he is a professor of international economics at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and a distinguished fellow of the Hoover Institution. Among his awards are the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award, the Eisenhower Medal for Leadership, and the Reagan Distinguished American Award. Secretary Shultz holds a bachelor's degree from Princeton and a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. William Perry served as the 19th U.S. Secretary of Defense under President Clinton. Currently, he is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute as well as a professor at Stanford University with a joint appointment in the School of Engineering and the Institute for International Studies. He is also co-director of the Preventative Defense Project, a research collaboration of Stanford and Harvard universities. Secretary Perry has received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Department of Defense Distinguished Service Medal, and the Outstanding Civilian Service Medals from virtually all branches of the U.S. military. Secretary Perry received his BS and MS degrees from Stanford University and his PhD from the Pennsylvania State University, all in mathematics. And now, please welcome Secretaries George Shultz and William Perry. The opening remarks will be by Secretary Shultz.
Bill Perry and I both feel very privileged to be working on this effort to rid the world of nuclear weapons. They constitute a tremendous threat, and the best way to deal with the threat is to get rid of them. The task is not easy, and as we've worked at it, we have outlined the steps that you need to take and have in mind and work at. They're hard if you're going to get there. As you said, we have been joined in this by Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn, two eminent officials who are very experienced, but also a great many other people. And I'll mention a minute from now just how that came about. Let me introduce you to this project by a little narrative, how it came into being and where we stand now. Not quite 22 years ago, I was sitting in a room in Reykjavik, Iceland, a little place called Hofti House, a little sort of isolated house at the time, where we were in a small room about the square of this background here, at a table about a little bit less long than this one. On one end sits Mikhail Gorbachev, then the General Secretary of the Soviet Union, and on the other is Ronald Reagan, the President of the United States. I was seated beside President Reagan and my opposite number in the Soviet Union, Edward Shevardnadze, was seated next to Gorbachev. There were four other people in the room. Each side had a note taker, and each side had an interpreter. Most of the interpretation was simultaneous translation, so you could connect the words with the body language. And both President Reagan and General Secretary Gorbachev were very expressive people. You almost didn't have to listen to what they said. You could look at them and know where they were standing. We talked about a great many things, and we weren't able to consummate the broad agreements that had been reached because we couldn't agree on the strategic defense issue. But nevertheless, once things get on the table, they don't come off. So I think it's fair to say that Reykjavik was the start of massive reductions in nuclear arms, although there's still a tremendous number today. Among the things that was talked about and agreed upon was the desirability of getting rid of nuclear weapons. Of course, everything was public after the meeting. And I can remember coming back to Washington, and the atmosphere was hostile. Margaret Thatcher arrived in a couple of days, more or less summoned me to the British ambassador's residence, and gave me a beating. How could I sit there and allow the president to agree to such a thing? I said, Margaret, he's the president. And she said, yes, but you're supposed to be the guy with his feet on the ground and common sense. I said, well, I agreed with him, Margaret. And that made it even worse. But her reaction was the general reaction, that this was a wild idea. When an article was published in the Wall Street Journal in January 2007 that Bill and I and Henry and Sam Nunn signed along with others, it was striking to me how different the reaction was. It was kind of a deep breath and, oh boy, somebody is on the right track. And the reactions from all over the world were broadly positive. I don't mean that everybody was instantly in agreement, by no means, but everyone was interested. And it was striking to me that even people, experienced people who didn't agree with the objective or thought it was impossible, nevertheless thought that the steps that we were recommending be taken were worthwhile and important in and of themselves. These steps, which we'll bring out as the session goes on, were registered on by people, and so we had a second conference at the Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Bill and I, Henry, Sam, and many others were present. And we commissioned papers by really able, informed, professional people on each of these steps. And we distributed them before the conference and told people, read before you come, because we're going to discuss them. We're not going to summarize them. And it was, I think, everyone agreed, a riveting conference. It was punctuated by the arrival of a wonderful letter of endorsement from Nancy Reagan and an interesting speech on the subject by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. I might say the only real controversy that evening was Arnold had prepared this speech, and he was fighting the fires in California. So he asked me to read it. And both Henry Kissinger and Gerhard Kasper, with their German accents, both objected. They said, we should have read it. We'd had a better accent. But at any rate, out of that came a second essay in the Wall Street Journal. And again, the reactions were very positive. We thought to ourselves, we should have a conference in some other country and invite people from other countries, because after all, this is something of global importance, and it will not take place without the participation of people from all over the world. And almost sort of out of the blue, there arrived an invitation from the government of Norway. They basically said, if you'll bring your act to Oslo, we'd like to have a conference. So we said yes. Sam and I were able to get there, Sam Nunn. They had 29 nations there. They had all the countries with acknowledged nuclear weapons present. And again, we had an extraordinary conference. We went on to London, and Bill was able to join us there, and Henry Kissinger was able to join us there. And we had a very interesting meeting with former foreign ministers and defense ministers from European countries, including two from Russia. And it was heartening to find that the government of Great Britain was on record clearly as in favor of this project. And in fact, they said they wanted to undertake in the project one of the key steps. They wanted to be sort of in charge of exploring the verification problem and how that could be done. So, of course, that's a very welcome development. I was interested in particular in the reactions of the Russians, because after all, the United States and Russia have to be ready to go on this together if it's going to go anywhere, because that's where over 90% of the nuclear weapons are. And the presentations by the two Russians were fascinating. And when they got through, I said to them, let me give you a short translation of what I heard, and you tell me if it's accurate. I said, my translation is that as far as Russia is concerned, the door is open. And they said, the door is wide open. So that was a matter of tremendous encouragement. So now we are trying to build these building blocks, to identify the steps, to continue work on the steps that need to be taken, so that we have prepared, should whoever is the next president of the United States think this is a good idea, prepared to say to that person, here are our ideas of the sort of steps you need to take. Here are papers that talk about them in a professional way, and the names of people who are knowledgeable, who are willing to work on it. And here are a bunch of people who are willing to stand up behind you and say, hooray. And they include around two-thirds of all the former living secretaries of state and defense and national security advisors, Republicans and Democrats. And also here are some indications of interest from abroad. And obviously, if this is to be undertaken seriously, you'll want to launch it as some sort of a common enterprise that isn't just the U.S. and Russia, but all of the countries who are particularly involved. Often when people look at the list of people who are working on this, and they look at the four sort of headline signers of the articles, Bill and I and Henry and Sam, They often say, well, isn't that nice in this atmosphere with all the publicity about how divisive everything is, that this is a bipartisan initiative? And we all say the same thing. We say, actually, it's not bipartisan. It's nonpartisan. We think this is the kind of subject that ought to be set out, looked at on the merits, argued about, but don't argue about it in terms of this is a Republican position or this is a Democratic position. Argue it in terms of what you think is right, what you think is wrong, what can be done constructively to make it better, and so on. Essentially, as a subject that we ought to put it above, put it to the side of partisan conflict and nourish it, because it is such an important initiative. And if we can achieve it, and along the way, if we can achieve the steps that I've outlined, we will make this world safer. And that's what we need. Thank you. Now I turn the mic over to my friend and colleague, Secretary Bill Perry.
And George spoke quite meaningfully about the response that our op-eds got. And I want to make the point that they got all that attention not because the ideas were so new. People have been proposing elimination of nuclear weapons for decades now. What was new about this was the people who were proposing them, four former Cold Warriors. Indeed, my experiences in the Cold War have had a profound influence on my views on this. I'm going to share one of them with you to start off my talk tonight. It occurred when I was the Undersecretary of Defense in the Carter administration. One night in the summer of 1978, I was awoken by a phone call. And I sleepily picked up the phone, and it was the general who was the watch officer that night, the North American Air Defense Command. He got right to the point. He told me that his computers were showing 200 missiles on the way from the Soviet Union to the United States. I immediately woke up. Of course, it turned out that this was a false alarm, but the general had less than 15 minutes to make that determination. He was calling me to see if together we could figure out what had gone wrong so he could explain to the president the next morning what had happened. Well, this was just one of three false alarms with which I am personally familiar. I don't know how many might have occurred in the Soviet Union during that same period, but I imagine at least as many. My conclusion from this is that we avoided a nuclear holocaust during the Cold War as much by good luck as we did by good management. In short, the risks of a nuclear holocaust, of a nuclear confrontation, to me were never academic. I lived with them every day. During that same period, I was responsible for developing the F-117, the B-2, the MX-ICBM, the Trident submarine, the Trident missile, the air launch cruise missile, the ground launch cruise missile, the sea launch cruise missile, all of these carriers of nuclear weapons. So how did I reconcile? On the one hand, understanding deeply the risks involved with our nuclear weapons, and on the other hand, going ahead to not only maintain our forces, but in strengthening and improving them. So I saw the risks. But during that period of time, during the Cold War, I believed, rightly or wrongly, I believed that it was necessary to take those risks in order to maintain our deterrence as a way of avoiding a nuclear war. That was a judgment I made then. But when the Cold War ended, my views changed. I did not see it was necessary to take those risks. And I believed we would quickly reach a stage where everybody came to that conclusion. I understood there would be a transition period. The transition period began immediately in the early 90s. we're not building any more nuclear weapons, but had to deal with the nuclear with the deadly legacy left over from the Cold War. My first opportunity to act on this myself occurred in 1993 when I went back to Washington, first as the Deputy Secretary of Defense and then as the Secretary of Defense. My first priority during all of my years in that job was dismantling nuclear weapons and safeguarding those nuclear weapons that were not dismantled. And the greatest immediate risk were in three countries, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, each of whom had inherited nuclear weapons from the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union broke up. Now, to put that in perspective, Ukraine had more nuclear weapons at that time than the United Kingdom, France, and China combined. There's a big store of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. The tools I had available to work on that task were the arms control treaties, a key one of which actually had been negotiated by George Shultz, the Nunn-Lugar program, which was pioneered in the Senate by Sam Nunn and Dick Lugar, and the cooperation of the Russians and the other republics of the former Soviet Union, in particular Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus. Their cooperation was absolutely essential for success. As I said, our major concern was Ukraine, not only because they had so many nuclear weapons, but because if you put your mind back to 1993, Ukraine was in political, economic, and social chaos. They're not a model republic today, but in 1993, it was really a dangerous situation. Using those tools, we set out to remove nuclear weapons from Ukraine with the support, with the permission of the Ukrainian government and with the support of the Russian government. During that period of time, I made four separate trips to the principal ICBM site in Ukraine, a place called Pervomysk, to oversee that operation. The first time I went there, I went to see the new warheads being removed. The second time, I went to see the missiles being removed for dismantlement. The third time, I went along with the Russian and the Ukrainian Minister of Defense to blow up one of those silos. And the fourth time, again with the Russian and Ukrainian defense ministers, we went together and planted sunflowers where that silo had been. We were set out to convert a deadly nuclear field, missile field, into a productive sunflower field. The result of that program, plus what we were doing in the United States at that time, was the dismantlement, the total dismantlement of 10,000 nuclear weapons in 4 years' time. The destruction of 1,000 launchers, and three nations, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus, went from being significant nuclear powers to zero nuclear weapons. I believed at the time that we were well on our way to this transition I talked about. But I have to say that that effort has stalled out. Today, Russia and China are building new nuclear weapons, and the United States is proposing to do the same. There have been no new dismantlement treaties since the one that George Shultz negotiated. Even the Moscow Treaty, which was negotiated 6 or 7 years ago, calls only for taking the weapons off deployment and putting them in warehouses, not dismantling them. We have never gotten the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty approved. This is what I mean when I say things have stalled out. On top of that, since that time, India and Pakistan have gone nuclear, and North Korea and Iran are not far behind. If North Korea and Iran go nuclear, I state this with sober, careful judgment, there will be a cascade of proliferation in Asia and in the Mideast. In the meantime, with all of these developments in nuclear weapons, we saw the emergence of what I call catastrophic terrorism. Not terrorism of setting off a pipe bomb in a restaurant, but terrorism in which thousands of people are deliberately killed by the terrorist. The most obvious example of that, of course, was 9/11. But there are earlier clues. as far back as the time when I was still the Secretary of Defense. There was a major bomb that blew up one of our barracks in Saudi Arabia, Khobar Towers. At the time, we did not connect that with 9/11 or anything of the sort. We did not connect it with that international movement in terrorism. About a year after that, I was made aware of a fatwa issued by Osama bin Laden relative to that event. And it was a fatwa on William Perry, the Secretary of Defense, who was busy trying to recover from that event. And that's when it began to dawn on me that this is really part of an international terrorist movement. Since then, we have seen documents from Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants speaking of their goal, literally goal of killing millions of Americans, and their interest in getting nuclear weapons as a tool for doing that. The risk today, therefore, is not a nuclear exchange between the superpowers, as there was during the Cold War. The risk is of a nuclear bomb going off in one of our cities, delivered not by a missile, but by a freighter or a truck. We had a workshop a few months ago in Washington called The Day After, where we assessed how well were we prepared for that and what would the consequences of it be. All of the experts who attended that workshop agreed that there was a significant likelihood of such an event occurring in a few years. All of them agreed that we were totally unprepared for it. All of them agreed that there are things we could do to respond to such an event, but we probably would not do them, and in any event, they would be limited effectiveness. That the key had to be in preventing the terrorists from getting the nuclear bombs in the first place, which we are not doing. Now, my bottom line from all of this previous discussion is that we are in a race to avoid a catastrophe, but we are not racing. Now, I've given you my assessment of why I decided basically to join George in this mission. We have taken on the task of trying to awaken the world to the incredible danger of these nuclear weapons. And we've agreed on a number of steps that could be taken. All of these steps could be taken now, this year, next year, not 10 years from now. Any of them would make our world safer now. But it is also fundamental, as George has already indicated, that international action is necessary to have any real results here. In particular, the steps we outline, nearly all of them require international action. International action will not be taken in the face of American exceptionalism. That is, one rule for us and different rules for all the rest of the world. The key to success in getting real action, real international action here, is a vision of the global elimination of nuclear weapons. Not eliminating in this country or the other country, but the global elimination of nuclear weapons. All the participants in our group will be quick to admit that that goal is very far away. What Sam Nunn called being on a mountaintop. It's so far away that we can't see clearly now how to get to it. But the least we could do is stop sliding down the mountain and start climbing up again. And that's what our steps are all about. Thank you.
Thank you to former Secretary of State George Shultz, former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, directors of the Nuclear Security Project. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'm delighted to be moderating the Q&A, and we have many questions from the audience, and I have just a few of my own, so let's get started. I think the questions group into a number of areas: the validity of the goal, the process for getting there, partnerships domestically and abroad for getting there, and so on. So let's start at the very beginning. I will refer people to the articles in the Wall Street Journal for a detailed explanation of the steps that the Schultz, Perry, Kissinger, Nunn group have set out, which are encompass at least 8 specific areas of activities. So we probably won't get into great detail about all of those, but where do we start? What would be the first step to get towards that goal of diminishing nuclear weapons to a great degree?
In our Wall Street Journal articles, we connected the steps with the vision. If you say, here is the vision, we want to get to a world free of nuclear weapons, that causes you to say, how would we possibly get there? What would we have to do? And then you start identifying clear, identifiable, difficult, but basically doable things that you can see will get you along that road. And those steps, in turn, give the vision a sense of reality. So there is an interaction. And I think we have to keep that interaction going. As Bill says, we may not be able to see the top of the mountain, but we know there is one. And we have to keep working toward it and see these steps as the way to do it.
There are a few of the steps fall in the category of reducing nuclear weapons, basically. We have already made progress on that. But as I said, that progress has been stalled in the last major treaty we had was the one that George Shultz negotiated. That's how long ago it goes back. I tend to minimize the treaties that have been negotiated since then because they do not really deal with the goal of eliminating nuclear weapons, dismantling. They only go do the goal of taking them off deployment. That's a worthwhile goal in and of itself, but it's not enough. So there have to be a set of steps taken on reducing them. That should be done through treaties, and I do believe that the START treaty that was negotiated by George is a model of the treaty in that it includes not only an agreement of what to be done, but a verification procedures for how you would get confidence that they are being done. So some of the actions have to do with reducing the number of nuclear weapons, first of all in the 2 superpowers and then extending that to around the world. Another set of steps have to do with reducing the danger of the weapons that are deployed. That has to do with safeguarding, and it has to do with increasing the time available to the people who have to launch these weapons. I told you the story of how the general had 15 minutes to make the decision. If you ask the general today how much time he has, the answer is 15 minutes. Nothing has changed. And that's crazy. We were not in the same situation we were in back in the 70s. So we still are susceptible to that kind of a false alarm. And a number of steps can be taken to reduce that kind of susceptibility. And finally, the nuclear danger occurs not just because of nuclear weapons. It occurs also because of the fissile material that exists in the world. There are thousands of pounds, kilograms of fissile material that are used in commercial reactors and research reactors, and a whole set of programs need to be underway to protect those from being stolen by or bought by a terror group. A terror group cannot, in my judgment, make a nuclear bomb from scratch. But if you give them the plutonium or the highly enriched uranium, the task becomes very much easier, and it's imaginable that they might be able to put a bomb together with that material. So we have to protect not only the bombs, but the fissile material as well. And there's several steps involved with the complicated procedures involved in trying to reduce the vulnerability of fissile material to being stolen.
I might say that the treaty Bill referred to, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty START, expires in December 2009. So it's essential to get to work and at minimum extend that treaty so that the verification provisions that are in it are not lost. And the experience with those verification provisions is not lost, because that's going to be the best guide to verification more broadly that we have.
Just to clarify, after 2009, there is no negotiated limit between the superpowers on strategic nuclear weapons that will be in place.
And no verification of whatever it is one might agree to. There have been, in Moscow in 2002, there was an additional understanding which could well be incorporated in the START treaty, but I don't believe it has been formally as yet. And so it doesn't have the same kind of verification procedures that the START treaty contains.
The recommendations you're making are activities that were on track, say, 10, 15 years ago. There were discussions about lengthening warning time and detargeting weapons, and there were strategic arms talks going on. Essentially, you're suggesting that we restart the type of activities and thinking that we had some time ago. What has happened in the last decade or so? How has this process fallen apart so that we're at a stage where we haven't made progress in these key areas?
Well, I think the subject just hasn't been on the front burner in the way that it was at earlier times. And while people have been paying attention, they haven't been paying attention as a number one priority issue. And if I expand it a little, why was it that the reaction was so different in January 2007 to what we said then 20 years earlier? And I think the answer lies in what Bill said, namely people felt in those days in the Cold War that the concept of deterrence, mutual assured destruction, played a role in keeping the peace, even though it was a dangerous role. I might say President Ronald Reagan always felt that was an immoral doctrine, and he never liked it much. But at any rate, people felt comfortable with that. Well, the Cold War is over now, and additional states have nuclear weapons. And just how does the system of deterrence really operate? The more states there are, the more variations there are among them, the more questionable the whole concept of deterrence is. And I think people are beginning to see that the whole nonproliferation effort is fraying, and we're going in the wrong direction. And so the reaction this time was totally different. And at least our hope is that we can get the subject on the front burner again, really pay attention to it, and then we can do something about it.
If you were,
Gloria, I think there have been two conditions that have substantially changed since the years I was working the problem in the Defense Department. The first is there is a degree of complacency that this is not a problem that is on people's agenda now. As of, in my judgment, it is a mistaken complacency, but nevertheless, it is there. It may even be reflected in the fact that we flew some nuclear missiles from one place to the other in the United States without even knowing the nuclear missiles were on the airplane. You may have read about the account in the newspaper. To me, that's indicative of the fact that the Defense Department in general and the government in general is not taking them seriously today, which is, in one sense, is good. It means they're not planning to take serious actions. In another sense, these are very dangerous weapons, and they have to be taken seriously. As long as they exist, they have to be taken seriously. The other thing that's changed then is that in 94, 95, we had excellent relations with the Russians. Today, we do not. And we must get on a very strong, positive term with the Russians to move forward in this field. Whatever other problems we have with Russia and its government and the way this government is managing, in this field, we have to have a very close and constructive working relationship with them.
Well, that brings up the question of what practical steps should be taken. So you have 8 different areas in which progress could be made. If you were designing a policy by the United States, what would you recommend to the president to do next week, the week after that? What would be the steps that would need to be taken to implement your vision?
Well, number one, sit down with the Russian leaders and extend the START treaty that will expire in 2009 and incorporate the agreements for further reductions that were agreed to in 2002 in that agreement. So that's something that can be done. It's very practical. I think what Bill mentioned, increasing the warning time, we have maybe 2,000 missiles aimed at each other with short warning times, that is, the time between when you get a warning that something has been fired at you and when you have to fire in order to protect your own ability to do so. And that's scary. Why do we need that? What conceivable dispute do we have with the Russians that would justify risking a nuclear exchange? There is nothing that I can think of, dispute that we might have with them, would cause us to want to risk that. So let's do something about those warning times. That can be done. It's a little difficult professionally, but not insuperable by any means.
Maybe Dr. Perry can explain how that would be done.
Well, if the president or the Secretary of Defense called in his military leaders and said, I want to increase the warning time, I want to decrease the risk of a false alarm, and I want you to propose to me the 8 things you're going to change to do to make that happen, I think you would get proposals like that and could act on them. I don't think either the President or the Secretary of Defense is in a position to lay out the detailed change in operational procedures, but they are in a position to say, this is the goal I want to achieve.
Of course, you'd want to do that negotiating it with the Russians so that they did the same thing.
Are some of our missiles still targeted out to sea? That's one way of increasing the warning time. Fine. Are missiles still targeted out to sea between the U.S. and Russia? Is our detargeting still in place?
I hope so.
The problem, however, Gloria, is that I don't know how many seconds it takes to retarget it.
Well, it's always said that it's a software problem. With regard to partners, you've mentioned working with Russia. Who would our other natural partners be in this effort as far as other countries go?
Well, you would certainly want to try to have a concert of nations that get going and start with all the countries that presently have nuclear weapons. And it was interesting to me recently in visiting India, a number of Indian officials expressed a great interest in this project, but they said, now don't do this as a U.S.-Russian condominium and cook it all up and then come to us and ask us to sign on. We want to be part of the process of designing what will happen. It reminded me of the lesson I learned when I was in office and working with the Congress. And they would say to me, if you want us in on the landing, include us in the takeoff. So we've got to do that with people.
Would there then be any particular vehicles or institutions that one would work through? Would it be the United Nations? Would it be regional groups? Or would it be a completely new initiative with a new way of collaborating?
Well, this is a diplomatic problem that those in charge would have to work out, but I should think you would start by going to the countries with nuclear weapons and creating a program. And then I think it's very useful to use the United Nations and the processes of the United Nations for creating it as something that operates on a world basis. I might say that the man in the United Nations who's in charge of this subject for the Secretary General came to both the meeting at Stanford's Hoover Institution last October and also to the one in Oslo. And was he at London? I think he was at London,
yes,
as well. So we've been keeping him totally informed and abreast And I think the United Nations is ready to play its part when we're ready.
The United Nations might not be playing an initiating role in this, but if we make success, they will play an absolutely critical role in the implementation of it through the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is a part of the United Nations. They have the facilities, they have the people, the trained people, they have the mission. So they would play an absolutely critical role.
Do you envision a launch or a formal a launch of this initiative as a practical diplomatic effort?
Well, it's something that a president of the United States has to decide to work on. And if he or she decides to do that, obviously you'll want to get broad support for it in the Congress and in the American people generally. And I think the fact that we have seen so many people in the United States who have held positions of experience and responsibility agree with this effort, that you can find a lot of people who will stand up and be ready to support. So you have to get started. But then you need to go to the other countries and make it a joint enterprise, not a U.S. Effort, but a joint effort on the part of everybody. And this will call for a huge diplomatic effort. And I believe myself that we aren't anywhere near adequately equipped diplomatically or diplomatic capability to do this, because it will be a big effort. It will be a kind of effort where our diplomats need to be able to work hand in glove with scientists who know, in a sense, better what you're doing in some detail. So we need to expand the Foreign Service. We need to hold on to the senior people there. We need to make it much more possible than it seems to be now for senior political figures to take part in this effort. And so it seems to me a big effort is needed in developing our diplomatic capability. I was in Washington earlier this year and listened to a speech by the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. And his speech was 100% devoted to the importance of developing our diplomatic capability. And he even said, Bill, that he might even be willing to put some of the defense budget over to it. I said to myself, that'll be the day.
That's a sign of real sincerity.
Perhaps the Defense Department would just do it.
I would add to this need for more diplomatic capability. The number of diplomats are not going to be instantaneously available to do what needs to be done. And if the new president decides to really launch this as a major initiative, besides trying to build up his diplomatic capability, he needs to take advantage of the many, many volunteers that would be available to work on this, or the non-governmental organizations, individuals like George Shultz he could call on. And that could make a difference, too. And I think you would find many former diplomats, many scientists, willing to sign up to work with them on this goal.
I guess what you're saying is that some of the capacity within the government for dealing with these issues has diminished.
Yes.
A good example is a colleague of Bill's and mine, Sid Drell, at Stanford. He is a brilliant physicist. He's been interested in the subject for a long time. He and I were the ones who at least got going with Bill this effort. And he's just the kind of person, he doesn't want to take a job in the government, but if he's asked to come in and spend time and give the benefit of his knowledge, it's more than ready to do it.
So there are a number of questions about some of the premises of what you're doing. For instance, several people want to know why nuclear weapons isn't in fact the use of biological weapons more likely? Isn't it also a deadly threat? Why focus just on nuclear?
Well, Bill probably can answer this more definitively than me, but the nuclear weapon is the most devastating. As I understand it, if one of the nuclear weapons of the capability that we have and the Russians have were exploded, say, over Manhattan Island, it would incinerate the island. They're unimaginable in their destructive capability. So that's, I think, why we have focus on them. There's been a lot of work done on biological and chemical weapons, and there are understandings about them. But the nuclear threat is the most devastating. It was striking to me once we were in Washington, and we had a little dog and pony show going on about this subject, and Henry Kissinger was one of them. And at one point he said, the thing, he said, that worried me the most, that I lost sleep over when I was in office, was what would I say to the president if he asked me my advice on whether to use a nuclear weapon, knowing that hundreds of thousands of people would be killed, and if there were a nuclear exchange, millions. What human being thinks they have a right to make that decision? Of course, the horrifying fact is we know that the terrorists that Bill was referring to want to get a nuclear weapon not to deter anything. They want to get one to use it.
You are listening to or watching the Commonwealth Club of California radio and television program. Our guests are former U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz and former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry discussing their nuclear security project aimed at ending nuclear weapons as a threat to the world.
Gloria, let me add one other point on the biological weapon question. The nuclear weapon, not only, as George has indicated, could be more devastating than a biological weapon, but it is a preventable catastrophe. If we can simply keep the nuclear weapons or the fissile material out of the hands of terrorists, they cannot do it. That is not true of biological weapons. Biological weapons can be made by terrorists. And our focus on biological weapons ought to be on how we respond to an attack. There are ways of greatly diminishing the effectiveness of a biological attack by well-planned and rapid responses. In the case of a nuclear attack, though, one must prevent them from happening, and it is preventable. Graham Allison has written a book on the subject called Nuclear Terrorism, and the subtitle is The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe.
So I think many people understand and probably support the front end of this process. That is, there are tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. We have tested means of arms control and verification for trying to reduce those. But I think a lot of people are concerned about the end stage. So let's say one were able to get the major nuclear powers to agree on decreasing numbers of weapons, increasing warning time, providing greater security for weapons and fissile material. What about the countries who have small numbers of nuclear weapons, the Indias and Pakistans? What about prospective nuclear countries, secretive nuclear countries like Israel and so on? How does one include them in this process, given that their numbers of nuclear weapons are so much lower that they wouldn't really be that relevant in the early stages of such a process?
Well, I think the question shows why it's so important to get started on a broad basis as a joint enterprise. And when they joined the enterprise, they would be understanding that obviously the U.S. and Russian arsenals, which are so much larger, would be coming down. But there would be a point fairly soon where countries that have 400 or 500 nuclear weapons would have to start looking at what they're going to do. And in the meantime, everybody would have an interest in, for example, verification provisions. How are you going to assure yourself that what is supposed to happen actually happens? And what do you do about, in a sense, the latency of a nuclear weapon being created once you have gotten to where you want to go and so on? So all of those questions, I think, people will want to be facing up to early on. There's another one that was interesting to me at this Oslo meeting, where, as I said, there were 29 nations represented, including all of the ones that had nuclear weapons. The subject kept coming up and was on their minds. What are the implications of all of the nuclear power plants that people expect to be built around the world? When you realize that if you can enrich uranium for a nuclear power plant, you've mastered the technology to enrich it for a weapon. And when you deal with the spent fuel, that can become plutonium. So the nuclear fuel cycle constitutes a problem that was very much on their minds. And, of course, one of the steps that we've talked about is getting control of the nuclear fuel cycle. It's a big diplomatic task, has a lot of physics in it, you might say. So it's that kind of a task. There is work going on. But, again, they were making the point, don't create another two-tier system where some countries can enrich uranium and other countries can't. That's not going to wash. You've got to get something that's under international control.
If we were to reach the stage where the world is down to 100 nuclear weapons, and then the question is asked, as you suggest, how do you get from 100 to zero? I have to tell you, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure that the answer is going to depend on the conditions in the world at that time. But the question, how do you get from 100 to zero, I would simply say, I would be very happy to be faced with that problem. I'd like to get it down to 100.
That would be a great problem to have.
And I do not believe we will get to that. Now, I don't believe we can take the steps necessary to get to that unless we have already stated the goal of getting to zero.
So we don't even need to address the question that some questioners ask, is it feasible to completely get rid of nuclear weapons? We're basically, we have a long way to go before that question even becomes relevant.
I think a fair question, though, is this, Gloria, and some people, some very astute observers have asked, including Harold Brown, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time I was describing this story about the false alarm at 3 in the morning. He raises the question, does having the goal of going to zero get in the way of the steps you want to take? That's a fair question. I think the answer to that question is no. It's quite the contrary, that if you do not have that goal, you will not be able to take these steps. And the best demonstration of that is what we have done the last 10 years without having such a goal. We've actually gone backwards, not forward. We've slid back down the mountain instead of moving up.
One of the people who has been an active participant in all of this work is named Max Kempelman. And he has a little speech that goes like this. He says, you have to remember the importance of the ought. We ought to be putting in front of ourselves all the time what ought to be. He uses our Declaration of Independence as an example. And when it was written, and we said all men are created equal, that was a long way from the reality at the time. But he argues the fact that ought was out there made us work at this and work at this and work at this. And with lots of steps forward and backwards and so forth, we've gradually come a lot closer to the ought. And so he argues that we need to have the goal, the ought, out there. And then we try constantly to get the is to come closer to it.
You mentioned the lack of viability of a two-tier system when it comes to uranium enrichment or any of the rest of this process. And that raises the question of the double standard that's often, where the U.S. is often pointed out as wanting other people to get rid of nuclear weapons while we keep ours, which raises the question of whether there's anything we could or should do unilaterally to start this process.
Well, I'm not in favor of unilateral disarmament. I think we need to do it as a negotiated matter, particularly, obviously, with Russia, but with other countries. And no doubt there are times when you can step up and do something and set an example and hope that other people will follow your example. But I think it's better to sit down and work it out with people and have an understanding. I'm going to do this and you're going to do that and so on.
It's not just a matter of a principle of not being unilateral. It is the fact that if we have solved the problem, if we've gotten rid of the American nuclear weapons but not getting rid of the Pakistan's, we have not solved the problem. The danger resides more fully with the Pakistan weapon for weapon than does with American or even Russian weapons. So the plan has to be a universal global plan for it to have any chance of success.
Several questioners want to know about citizens or public support for this. What can an individual do? What kind of groups in the U.S. might be helpful to support? Are you doing outreach to citizen groups? What needs to be done in that area at home?
Well, I don't believe you had to ask Bill or I twice to come and appear at the Commonwealth Club.
That's absolutely true.
And the Commonwealth Club is one of the places in the country that has a program that gets broadcast all over. So you try to explain to people what you're doing and encourage them to inquire and so on. And as they do that, they take a part. And maybe when you go to a political meeting, you might say, where do you stand on this? Not that we want to get it into the partisan debate. We want to keep it out of that. But still, I think when it gets on people's minds, that tends to get it on the government authorities' minds.
I see two steps, Gloria. The first step is an education step. We're in the process of doing that right now, and you're in the process of helping us do it right now. A second step is a political action step, and I see that beginning with the transition period of the next administration. I think it would be a mistake to try to bring it into the middle of the primary period. But whenever a president is selected, whenever he starts to select the cabinet, during that transition period, when he's starting to lay plans, what he or she's going to do during his term in office, that's the time for political action to be felt.
After returning from Washington from serving with Dr. Perry, Senator Alan Cranston involved me in an effort that he had that was somewhat similar to this, positing the goal of zero nuclear weapons, and he built a coalition of former military people and Russian generals and, you know, former elected officials and so on. It did not go very far within his lifetime. Any analysis of why that was, why your effort would, certainly your effort has a higher level set of and more bipartisan set of supporters. What would make this effort different and more effective?
Well, first of all, let me tell you a story about Senator Alan Cranston. Being from California, I was from California as Secretary of State. And he came around to me once and he said, if you can negotiate a significant arms control treaty with the Soviet Union, I'll do everything I can to help get it ratified. I'll oppose it if that helps. I'll support it if that helps. I'll do anything to help you get it ratified.
Good point.
I think the timing that just by chance came with these op-eds that Bill and I and others have taken part in has been fortuitous. It seemed to strike a chord at the right time. Timing means a great deal in these things.
Do you have plans for broadening your coalition by, say, including ex-presidents, ex-former leaders of other countries?
Well, quite a few have come forward, and I won't volunteer anything for former presidents. They'll speak for themselves, but I'm optimistic. Former President Gorbachev of Russia has written an article in the Wall Street Journal supporting what we're doing. We've focused more on gathering support from former officials and not put sitting officials on the spot until we really have our ducks in a row and everything set. Although it is interesting that the British government has explicitly endorsed what's going on, and as I said, wants to be in charge of the verification business or take that on. And the Russian government has acted favorably in terms of a public speech by the foreign minister.
It's the time now for our last question, and I'm going to read this question while thanking you for the legacy that you're trying to leave the world. What is the role and or responsibility of the younger generations with little memory of the Cold War in directing or inheriting the effort to move the world towards nuclear zero? And I would add, how does one transmit that sense of responsibility to those who did not live through the key events of the Cold War?
Well, I'm spending some of my time trying to get this out to the public as we are doing today, but a good bit of my time I spend at Stanford teaching. And I'm teaching students on national security issues because, in my judgment, what we are trying to do here will not be done in 10 years fully or 20 years fully. It's going to take the next generation or even the next generation to make it happen. So we have to work with students to pass the baton on to them to let them carry this forward.
After all, the people you're talking about are the future, and this is their future we're discussing here. I have found my own children and grandchildren, they ask me about it. And I think young people are very alert to these kinds of issues and want to talk about the future. So let's help them do it.
Our thanks to Secretary George Shultz, Secretary William Perry, directors of the Nuclear Security Project, for your comments. Thanks to our audience here today in San Francisco, our audiences on radio, the internet, and television, and to Pitch and Kathy Johnson, who underwrote today's program. And our thanks to Dr. Perry and Mr. Shultz for their tremendous work on behalf of all of our futures. I'm Gloria Duffy. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened dialogue, is adjourned.